13-23-196 yard, Jonathan Paul Jones versus the state of Texas.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Before this tragedy unfolded, Jonathan Jones was a devoted father, devoted husband, a distinguished member of the United States Marshal Service, working one of the most difficult divisions within the Western District of Texas. And he is currently serving an 11 and a half year sentence for a crime that he was acquitted of. That is a travesty that this court has the power to fix, and it is the most pressing issue in this case. And it's an issue that functionally the state of Texas has conceded. The state concedes that intoxication manslaughter and manslaughter are the same offense for the purposes of double jeopardy. And the case law has extensively recognized that these two crimes are both descriptive of involuntary manslaughter. The state also concedes that had the shoe been on the other foot and Mr. Jones had been convicted of both intoxication manslaughter and manslaughter, the court would have to vacate one of those counts of conviction and render conviction on the other. There's no reason why, understanding that jeopardy principles apply to these two offenses, we wouldn't logically recognize that if you are acquitted of intoxication manslaughter as count one, the jury would not be able to continue on and pass judgment on the secondary question of manslaughter in count two. That just simply...
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Chief.
No, you go ahead.
Sorry, Your Honor.
So,
probably the same question.
Probably the same question. So if that is true, what you are arguing to this appellate court, then there would be no reason to charge them with both. There would be only one charge.
They should never have charged both of these as separate crimes.
But isn't that common to do?
Unfortunately, it's a ridiculously common practice, but it is wrong. The indictment could have been set aside as a multifarious indictment or for multiplicity because the indictment authorized a conviction on more than one offense for the same underlying crime, the same deceased person. These offenses should have been summarily dismissed at the motion to quash phase of the proceeding. They were not.
Mr. Hunter, what you're arguing for us is to make new law this morning because this is how these cases are normally charged throughout the state of Texas.
Well, Your Honor, I can say that in my own personal experience, I have quashed indictments like this before. I think that trial judges with regularity encounter this problem. But unfortunately, the lawyer did nothing and made no objection. In this case, we have a slightly different problem because this is an exceedingly rare issue. And it's one of the reasons why I think that the state really can't point to any authority that says that these principles shouldn't apply naturally this way. If you think about it, most people who are going to be before your honors have been convicted of both offenses, or they were convicted of a lesser included offense and acquitted of the greater offense. And so those circumstances would not trigger jeopardy. It's an extremely rare circumstance where someone has been both subjected to the danger of double jeopardy because they were indicted in two separate counts with the same crime, which happened here, and that proceeded to a verdict where count one was a not guilty verdict. So it's an unusual circumstance, but I don't think, Your Honor, that we're
making
it law.
So let's talk about what you need for three types of double jeopardy. If we are saying this is a violation of a double jeopardy, under the Garifas case, which is the 2014, there's three types of double jeopardy: a second prosecution for the same offense, a second prosecution for the same offense after conviction, and then multiple punishments for the same offense.
That's correct.
Where does this fit?
This is a prosecution after acquittal. And we can think about that both in the most linear and simple way possible. And I think we need to also look at it at a 20,000 foot view. In this specific case, sequentially, the jury was first asked to consider count one of the indictment, which was intoxication manslaughter. They found Mr. Jones not guilty of that offense. They then proceeded to consider count two of the indictment, which was regular old manslaughter, and they convicted him. So in a very true linear time sense, the jury returned a verdict of guilty after they had first found the man not guilty. So we can look at it from that perspective.
Has that ever been done, that we've looked at it linear like that, where the jury decides one and then decides the next one?
I can't find a case like that, Your Honor. But I mean, like I said, I don't expect to. This is such a rare occurrence where you would have this particular outcome on top of what is already a procedurally infirm prosecution. I mean,
well, you know, there is the Galvan v. State case, which, of course, you've criticized, and we both happen to be on panel on that case.
We
And
understand.
what's interesting, yes, we don't take it personal. But it to me, that's interesting because it's a similar situation here. And it was a pet refused case. So if that truly was a concern for the court statewide, you'd think they would have taken this case and addressed that.
Well, and if correct me if I'm wrong, Your Honor, but when we're talking about Galvan, we're sort of transitioning into the secondary question, which is whether it's a res judicata question or whether it's a legal sufficiency analysis in its own right. How can we harmonize these inconsistent verdicts? Because they plainly are. Count one was intoxication manslaughter, and count two was manslaughter, manner and means of driving the wrong way and or drinking
True.
alcohol.
That's true. They didn't raise double jeopardy in Galvan, is what you're
And they
saying.
didn't raise double jeopardy squarely in Galvan. And I would also submit, Your Honor, that Galvan is looking at this from the very cut and dry black letter law proposition that Dunn versus United States, which is 284 US 390, is somehow a blanket prohibition on jurists analyzing sufficiency of the evidence when the verdicts are inconsistent. And I don't think that Dunn is being treated that way. The United States Supreme Court itself and Sealfon, Sealfon versus United States, 332 U.S. 575, functionally overruled Dunn, at least as to the basic idea that there can't ever be a scrutiny of the evidence that takes into consideration the inconsistency between two verdicts. And I think that that's really at play here. In these specific cases, there would be no way to accept the juror's conclusion that he's guilty of regular manslaughter as a rational choice, given that what they had in the tank, as far as what the state actually put on in this case, was manifestly insufficient. And I just want to say, because the briefing is really focused on where I assume we're going to have disagreements and where we're going to have some tension because we have to harmonize things like Galvan against Dunn. But I do, and just I plead with you all to take a look at that record and see how summarily the defense destroyed any evidence of intoxication in
You
this
seem
case.
to want us to completely disregard all the evidence of the intoxication proof in order to make the legal to make a legal sufficiency argument on the straight manslaughter. But shouldn't we look at the whole record, whether the jury found him guilty or not guilty of intoxication, isn't under this legal review of the legal sufficiency that we have to look at the whole record, including those things that the jury may have decided didn't find him guilty? I mean, it doesn't like we throw out that evidence in reviewing legal sufficiency.
I think we would rise to the challenge. If we really want to look at the record, I don't think that you're going to find anything persuasive in that record that demonstrates Mr. Jones was intoxicated. The blood analysis in the case was the worst that two different independent experts had ever seen in terms of the quality controls of the lab. So the blood evidence, I don't think any rational juror could have given that any weight whatsoever. It just wasn't science. It'd be like asking a kindergartner to test the blood example. The remainder of the evidence doesn't get us to the point of intoxication. What the state has is some evidence that Mr. Jones consumed alcohol that evening, but
Can
we can't
consuming
authorize that.
alcohol, Mr. Jones consumed alcohol, however much he was, then decided to drive and then went the wrong way on an up ramp. Isn't that sufficient evidence to find reckless under the manslaughter?
Your Honor, I would submit no. I mean, the problem is intoxication solves this
You
problem.
understand? I know that you think no, but we have a jury verdict that says yes,
I understand
and
that.
we have to
One
rule.
that is manifestly inconsistent with the other jury verdict that we also have to give deference to. That's problem number one. And I would submit that despite Dunn's holding, you can use the inconsistent verdict to help your analysis of the evidence. But putting that issue aside, the evidence that was adduced at the trial does not establish intoxication. If the court were to affirm a conviction on manslaughter on the sole basis that someone consumed alcohol, without any evidence whatsoever that that consumption of alcohol caused the incident, or any evidence whatsoever that that consumption of alcohol in any way caused him to become aware of a substantial risk and consciously disregard it, or become unable to apprehend those substantial risks and thereby disregard them. There's no evidence of that. If we're going to
There be
convict him
evidence
on.
of impairment without reaching the level of legal intoxication?
Well, the problem is, Judge, I don't know how we harmonize that because the statute that sets forth the definition of legal intoxication talks about any loss of normal mental and physical faculties. So any diminution of your ability to appreciate the circumstances around you would necessarily be legally intoxicated in the state of Texas. And the jury flat out had to reject that conclusion, and rightfully so. The evidence in this record will not persuade anyone that this man was intoxicated.
I understand that the jury may have decided that he was in intoxication due to the fact of they might have trouble with the experts and the ability. But that did not give away to the jury's ability to find that he was somehow impaired. How without that, because he was drinking, and that led to a reckless disregard
I
and
fear
the
that if
mass.
we were to indulge that logic, we would essentially be creating a sub rosa presumption that consumption of alcohol means impairment in any kind of a case in which a lesser culpability than intentional or knowing conduct is at play. And that would be an unconstitutional presumption. That would be invading the province of the jury. And that's functionally why this was done. I mean, let's just be practical about it. The state wanted to do this because they were afraid that they would not be able to prove intoxication. And so they have essentially, by virtue of this incorrect and illegal charging practice, created this secondary theory of liability that's
Well,
nowhere
had
in the
they
penal
not
code.
charged the intoxication and manslaughter, then they wouldn't have the evidence of the alcohol
That's right.
consumption, what you're saying?
That, well, what I'm saying is it's a way for them to get a conviction functionally on intoxication manslaughter on a lesser burden of proof. And that shouldn't be something that we indulge.
What do you mean a lesser burden of proof? I don't understand why you think it's a lesser burden of proof.
What we're saying, I mean, the jury was given an instruction that defined intoxication as it's set out in Chapter 49 of the Penal Code, and the jury rejected that possibility in this case. Any other kind of impairment would be outside of any statute authorizing its prohibition or criminal behavior. And so, I mean, could we imagine a scenario where someone is drinking not to the level of impairment and also engages in reckless activity? Sure, we could. Those scenarios exist. This record doesn't have that evidence.
What do you think the jury based its finding of recklessness on, if not
Well,
the
I think that the
alcohol?
jury made an irrational decision that we have to reverse and render acquittal on. That's what I am firmly of the opinion of. I mean, I can
It was
understand.
driving up the ramp. You're saying that in of itself is not enough because you have to show he intentionally knew he was doing that and disregarded the risk.
If it's an accident, if you accidentally turn the wrong way on a street, that's not reckless conduct. It
It
wasn't,
can be.
if you
It
were
can.
aware of the risk and you
It can be.
consciously disregarded.
Running a red light can be reckless. If you know there's a red light and you run it, it can be reckless. Going up the wrong way on a ramp, whether you're drinking or not, can be considered
No
reckless.
question. I'm not disputing that. But we have to have some evidence that we appreciated what we were doing, that we knew we were driving the wrong way up that ramp. And that we disregarded the risk associated with it. And there is a case to be
That a
made.
pretty high burden for the state to be able to show that this, the defendant would have appreciated the risk.
I don't think it's that high of a burden because they had the opportunity to prosecute him for intoxication and manslaughter. I mean, and when if you're just thinking about it casually, you might say, if someone drove the wrong way up a ramp, something had to have been wrong. You don't do that under normal circumstances. My position is, unless you're suicidal, no one would do that of their own volition. But we don't have enough evidence of intoxication, which leaves only one other possibility, which is mistake. And
Well,
there's
it
been no
couldn't be
effort to
not.
try
I
and.
mean, I think it depends what you say by intoxication. Does intoxication mean that you're 0.08? Or does intoxication mean I drank and therefore it impaired my ability to recognize that I shouldn't go up this ramp because it's a down ramp, not an up ramp?
No question that intoxication doesn't have to be past the legal threshold of 0.08, but the statute we have for intoxication is extremely broad and would cover any loss of your mental or physical faculty. So we have a workable definition that cannot be evaded by someone who's trying to pretend they weren't impaired when they are, despite the fact that they're below the legal limit, that was considered by this jury and rejected. And whether we look at this from the Jeopardy perspective, which I think is the easiest way for us to solve this, because it really, I think, is just as cut and dry as that. Or if we look at it from the sufficiency perspective, recognizing that while Dunn isn't completely overruled, and you certainly could have inconsistent jury verdicts, there is room for the court to recognize a jury's natural rejection of the obvious facts that would have had to be rejected when considering whether the jury was rational in making its secondary decision on the second count. And I don't see why We have to set up a blinder on that just because that verdict is inconsistent. I think that that comes in. It's part of fair consideration. But again, the state of the record itself is very powerful for Mr. Jones on this issue. I don't think that the state has any proof of impairment, much less intoxication. What they have is consumption of alcohol. We shouldn't convict on that basis. I reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it
Morning.
please the court. My name is Eric Rodriguez. I'm here on behalf of the Bexar County District Attorney's Office. Mr. Hunter is asking this court to misapply the law and invent precedent that does not exist. According to Chris v. Behrens, 437 U.S. 28, jeopardy attaches when the jury is sworn. This was all in the same instance of jeopardy. This is longstanding precedent that an indictment can charge offenses that would violate double jeopardy if a defendant was convicted of both. That goes back to Ball versus United States, 470 U.S. 856, and U.S. v. Gaddis, 424 U.S. 544. What probably happened in this case is the defense attorneys knew that a judge in a different court made a wrong decision, not following the law, and it kind of spreads around the trial courts. Hey, if you've got intox manslaughter and manslaughter in the same indictment, you can get it quashed and try it out. And I think that's what Mr. Hunter's following, is that someone somewhere made an incorrect decision based on the law. But let's assume for a fact, or let's assume for a moment, that Mr. Jones was convicted of both intoxication manslaughter and manslaughter. According to Ex parte Cavazos, 203 Southwest 3rd, 333, and Guerrero, I believe it's 330 Southwest 3rd, 546, the remedy is just to not impose one of the punishments. No court has ever authorized total vacation of both convictions. And so, as far as the double jeopardy point of error, the law is completely settled that the state can charge intox manslaughter and manslaughter in the same indictment. And I think that goes into his sufficiency argument. We're looking at the hypothetically correct.
So what about his argument of this linear, that because the jury first found him not guilty of intoxication manslaughter, at that time, the double conviction attaches and you can't go to voluntary manslaughter?
I don't think there's any case law or statute to support
that. I agree
that,
with
Your
you,
Honor.
But.
And I think that goes into the sufficiency. So when you look at cases like Dunn, but also Powell, 469 U.S. 57, excuse me, all we know is that the verdicts are inconsistent. And trying to speculate about what the jury thought and why they made the decision they did is improperly invading the role of the fact finder. So when we get into the sufficiency, I thought it interesting that Mr. Hunter didn't bring up the case Zuniga, which he cites extensively in his brief. And I think the reason for that is because he read it completely wrong. And so that's in that Zuniga case, the Court of Criminal Appeals was trying to hash out exactly how to apply the factual sufficiency standard, which no longer exists in criminal law. And so in the Zuniga case, they weigh the weight of the contrary evidence in factual sufficiency, but we don't do that in the legal sufficiency review under Jackson versus Virginia. We're looking at the hypothetically correct jury charge to find the essential elements of the offense. What are the essential elements here? Recklessly causing death. And if you look at this record, you can be more than assured that there were multiple avenues for the jury to convict Mr. Jones. So there was evidence of impairment by alcohol. That is in the record. And Mr. Hunter completely ignores Chambers and all the other sufficiency cases that say a jury does not have to believe the testimony of a witness. They can believe all, some, or none of that evidence. And so, yes, Mr. Jones brought forward experts who may have cast doubt on some of the intoxication evidence, but the jury was not required to believe it, that evidence. And I would submit that the state also impeached those witnesses. They brought Ms. Culbertson, who had never testified in any other manner than finding that a lab was wrong in how they were doing things. You had the other witness, I believe Dr. Jimmy Valentine, who wanted to charge the state $1,000 to get their expert report, even though they had already prepared that report for the defense. So as far as the evidence that was meant to cast doubt on intoxication, there was some reason to doubt the experts that Mr. Jones brought forward. So
besides expert testimony, was there just testimony that he had drank?
So there was.
I mean, I know there was a lot of question as to how much he had drank or what his blood alcohol. But was there just evidence that was undisputed that he had been drinking?
No, Your Honor, there was a lot more than that, actually. One of the things that happens in the when we're talking about recklessness, and especially in like the shooting cases where somebody accidentally shoots somebody else, the case law recognizes that the statements that a defendant makes are going to be self-serving, and the jury can often doubt those statements. So what happened in this case was Mr. Jones says, "I had two beers." But then the jury can look at the dash cam video, States Exhibit 9, and Officer De La Rosa asks him, "Well, what kind of beers did you have?" I think it takes him about 2 minutes to even come up with a brand. I believe finally he comes up with that he had two Michelob Ultras. But you'll see Officer De La Rosa has to really pull it out of him. He's like, I had two beers, two light beers, two, I don't know what kind they were, Michelob Ultra. You'll see that when you watch States Exhibit 9. And you can see how he does on the field sobriety tests. Now, the field sobriety tests were in a lot of contention in the record because one of this defense's experts said, oh, okay, he potentially had a head injury, so the SFST shouldn't have been done. Again, that's something that the jury can disregard. And again, the defense never brought forth evidence that he suffered a head injury. They made in the when you read the record, you'll see that they made a lot of hay about he was had a head injury, he had a head injury, he had a head injury. This never should have been done. They shouldn't have even been talking to him. But the record also showed that he was medically cleared at the magistrate's office, and that would be in 10, the volume 10 of the reporter's record on page 108. When he's talking to Officer De La Rosa, he only complains about his wrist. And then maybe about 5 to 10 minutes later, he says, oh yeah, my head hurts too. And then he actually argues with Officer De La Rosa, saying, oh, you actually didn't ask me about my head. And that's evidence that the jury can use to find the impairment by alcohol element that they did when they found him guilty. But that's just a piece of the puzzle that they had to find recklessness. So they had the evidence of impairment by alcohol, and they also had the evidence that he drove the wrong way. So I believe Mr. Hunter said it's difficult to determine whether or not he knew that he was doing this. But the law recognizes that, especially in cases like Laster, 275 Southwest 3rd, 512. So finding recklessness is necessarily going to require the jury to rely on circumstantial evidence. It's very rare that you're going to have someone say, oh, I saw this and I disregarded it intentionally. And again, that goes to the self-serving statements, right? When Officer De La Rosa is talking to Mr. Jones, he says, oh, I didn't know I was going the right way or I was going the wrong way. So the jury has to piece together those pieces of circumstantial evidence that they can make reasonable inferences from and weigh the same as direct evidence to find whether or not he consciously.
Besides the drinking information, he was going up the wrong way on a ramp. What evidence do we have that he acted? If we try to take the drinking out of it, for lack of a better word, does the state still prove recklessness in this record?
Yes, Your Honor. And part of the reason I brought Defendant's Exhibit 34 up here is so the court can kind of appreciate the different ways that the evidence showed that he might have come. So if you follow Luke 1604, he could have been coming the right way, but then decided to make an illegal U-turn on the ramp. Or what defense argued at trial was that he came up Barshop Boulevard and turned left. And the even more severe would be him coming from Walter Brennan is further down there. You'll see in the record, driving the wrong way even longer to get up the ramp. And so I believe it is Defense Exhibit 38. You'll get a good picture, if you believe that he came up Bar Shop, of what that intersection looked like. And even though it's in broad daylight, you'll see that there's a lot of traffic control devices, solid white line, concrete median, that if you believe he was going up the Bar Shop route, he would have had to turn around in a very strange way to get up the highway. So in finding that, regardless of whichever way he came from, the record shows that there was traffic control devices that he would have had to consciously disregard in order to go up the wrong way. And if you don't believe that he consciously disregarded those signs, then you would almost have to believe that he was driving with his eyes closed, which would in itself be reckless. So there's case law that says a defendant need not be aware of a specific risk of another's death to commit manslaughter. And that's Trepanier, 940 Southwest 2nd, 827. And that's a case out of Austin, but it was pet-refed by the Court of Criminal Appeals. So the jury has all these items of evidence. They have the evidence of his impairment from alcohol. It may not have they may not believed it. They may not have believed that it rose to the level of intoxication. But even then, in cases like Zuniga on remand, in cases like Lovelace, which I believe I cited in my brief, it still becomes a piece of the puzzle that the jury can use to find whether or not Mr. Jones was reckless. And so I believe in this case, Your Honor, Your Honors, there's more than enough evidence for the jury to find that Mr. Jones consciously disregarded a risk that he would cause an accident, and by causing that accident, cause Ms. McCowan's death. There was a tragedy in this case, but it wasn't Mr. Jones's conviction. Now, I'd like to move on to the exclusion of Mr. Avila's statement. I submitted a supplemental brief to the court, and I think both parties kind of missed this in the record. So when the state was putting on its evidence, there was the gardeners, and they testified about Mr. Jones's headlights potentially being on or off. Or I wasn't paying attention. So Mr. Jones wanted to get into Mr. Avila's statement, who had unfortunately passed away before the trial. They tried to get it in under the rule of optional completeness. Now, the trial court didn't buy that argument and didn't want to let it in. But then much later in the trial, Mr. Jones brings up that issue again and says, Your Honor, we'd really like to get into this issue. And he ends up allowing it. So I think in that situation, there's just not an appealable error because ultimately Mr. Jones got what he wanted when he was allowed to cross-examine Detective Maria Salazar about Mr. Avila's statements. And even if this court doesn't believe that it was an appealable error, the trial court has the discretion to limit the application of the rule of optional completeness under 403. And so if you read the conversation that the parties have in the seventh volume of the reporter's record, you'll see that Mr. Jones says, I want to bring this evidence in. And the state says, okay, well, if they bring this evidence in, I want to bring more statements in under that same rule. And so I think it's up to the trial court's discretion to determine, you know, how far is too far? How far do we want to get into this? The record itself was pretty voluminous, and for good reason, of course. This is a very serious case, but the trial judge has the responsibility to move the trial along to make sure that not getting bogged down. So I think even if you find that this was an appealable error, the trial court made the right decision under its discretion. You know, you're in that zone of reasonable disagreement place. And then even if you don't believe that, then you can find that it's harmless. And that's because the exclusion of cumulative evidence is in and of itself harmlessness and for the harmless. And for that, I'd cite Robinson 461 Southwest 3rd 194.
And is the entire statement that appellant has complained about in his brief, is that what was put in through to Detective Salazar?
So they didn't put in the entire statement. I believe it was about the exhibit is about a 10 minute audio recording. They didn't publish the whole statement, but if you read both when they have the discussion in the seventh volume and when they bring it back up, Mr. Jones wanted to bring that evidence in solely for the purpose of impeaching the gardener's testimony that the lights were off, or I don't remember what the lights were. They wanted to bring in that evidence to say, have somebody else say that the lights were on. And they did that. They got that same evidence before the jury to try to make that same kind of causation argument that they were making. So at the end of the day, while the state does not believe this is an appealable error, even if this court thinks that the trial court erred, it's harmless. And then the last point is about Dr. Eftekar's testimony. So Dr. Eftekar talked extensively about, you know, traffic control devices, the routes that Mr. Jones could have taken. But first, I would submit that this point of error is actually inadequately briefed. So if you look at Mr. Jones's brief, there is no mention of how Rule 703 and how the expert rules were violated here, how the trial court abused its discretion. Jones failed to make an argument about that, or Mr. Hunter failed to make an argument about that. All he does is go straight to harm. And I think there's something to be said about whether or not this was even an error in the first place. So under the expert rules 703, 702, experts can testify about things that may otherwise be inadmissible. But there is a limitation on that. And for that proposition, first I would look to Burton, because there's obviously not a lot of case law on this issue. But Burton says that we can look to how federal courts in other states have interpreted the issue. And that's 428 Southwest 3rd, 865. So I believe it's the Seventh Circuit. There's a case called Lundy, 809 Federal 2nd, 392. It's within the trial court's discretion to determine whether to allow an expert statement that would backdoor in inadmissible hearsay. So throughout Dr. Eftekar's testimony, he is undoubtedly a remarkable expert on traffic reconstruction, on how traffic control devices should work. But he relied.
And you didn't challenge his qualifications in any way at all. So that's why the only issue that's being raised, I guess, is that this testimony was not allowed.
Yes, Your Honor. The state is recognizing that he's a very well-renowned expert in that department. But when he was giving his testimony about where Mr. Jones was and which route he took before he got to the impact location, he testified that he didn't have a lot of that data that he would otherwise rely on. So the record showed that something was wrong with the GPS in Mr. Jones's truck. So while otherwise he would be able to pinpoint exact coordinates of where he was before the accident, he didn't have that. And that's volume 12, page 44. He believed it was in spotty reception, so he couldn't rely on that data to tell him where he was before the crash. So the state took him on voir dire, and they found that the only way that he could say where Mr. Jones was before the crash was by talking to Mr. Jones. And that is an improper substitution for his testimony. The cases of Lundy and Salem, 370 U.S. 31, 703 allows some hearsay to come in if an expert would ordinarily rely on that, but it can't be the mere conduit, and that's the important language, mere conduit for inadmissible hearsay. And that's what would have happened in this case. And so that's why the trial court didn't err, because it used its discretion to say, hey, the only way that evidence would otherwise come in is if Mr. Jones came in and testified about that. So an expert can't ordinarily rely on this when he's using data, when he's using GPS coordinates. So it's within his discretion to decide, okay, that evidence is not going to come in. But even then, if the trial court or if the court believes that this is error, I don't think it changes the outcome of the case. And because the record is so strong that Mr. Jones was reckless when he operated the vehicle, whether or not the jury believed that he was impaired, but even then, that goes improperly into.
Well, could it have bolstered their argument that it was a simple mistake that he made?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because regardless of which way he came, the only thing that it really supports is which way he came up to get to the crash. So regardless of which way he came up to the crash site, he still had to go the wrong way. He still had to disregard traffic control devices. And he was going 50 miles an hour up the ramp. One of the important things that came from Dr. Eftekar's testimony is Defense Exhibit 59. Defense Exhibit 59 was Dr. Eftekar pulling the available GPS data from both cars, and he was able to create an animation of the crash. And using that data, you can actually see the way that Mr. Jones drove up the ramp. And the jury may have relied on that evidence, say, because when you watch the demonstration, he's swerving within the lane. And the jury may have used that evidence to find he's impaired. Whether or not he's legally intoxicated, that impairment, they could still use that to find the impairment that's the piece of the puzzle that gets them to recklessness. And so ultimately, Your Honor, this is a case where the court is being asked to create law that doesn't exist and misapply existing law. And we would ask that this court affirm Mr. Jones's conviction. And the state will waive the rest of the time.
Thank you.
Thank you. You may proceed.
The notion that this is somehow a novel question or that we're going off into uncharted territory is just ridiculous. The doctrine of multiplicity has been a principle of charging law in the state of Texas for over 100 years, and its purpose is explicitly to prevent violations of the Double Jeopardy Clause by allowing people to be convicted of the same crime in multiple counts. That is about as well settled a law as there possibly could be. And the notion that this is getting some judge to go along with a screwball idea and that it isn't actually the law either. This court has reversed or has vacated counts of conviction completely, not just simply permitted one punishment. Castillo versus State, I can't give you the site, but that's mine. I did that one, and I know that that's how they do it. So that idea just needs to be jettisoned. This isn't some screwball crackpot idea. This is bedrock charging law principles. In fact, the idea...
I agree with you that it's not a... that there seems to be a conflict. I am not sure, however, as an appellate court, if we can use this linear argument in order to fix what possibly could be a charging problem.
Well, and I suggest the linearity argument because I anticipate that their contention will be that because it's not a subsequent prosecution, but it's the same prosecution, that somehow all of this is cured. And so I just want us to think about the fact that if we're going to indulge in legal fictions, there actually is a literal progression of time from passing on count one to passing on count two that we can latch on to. But frankly, I don't think that that's the right way to read the Jeopardy Clause. The idea that because these are both happening simultaneously, and they point to you to the notion that jeopardy attaches when the jury is sworn, all the rest of the stuff, go back to first principles. Why do we have a prohibition on multiplicity? Because it subjects the defendant to double jeopardy. United States versus Reagan out of the Fifth Circuit gives a very good analysis of that. I believe it's cited in the brief, but I can certainly submit a supplemental on it. The notion is that an indictment that would force you to be subjected to two convictions for the same crime is a defective indictment. And prior to 1985, when we just through fiat changed the Constitution to where all objections to the indictment had to be raised before trial or they were waived, it was a jurisdictional threat to proceedings. The conviction could be vacated in its entirety based solely on the charging error and without regard to the final outcome. He could have been convicted of both and punishment reformed, and they could still have dismissed the indictment because it would be jurisdictionally infirm. Arguably, I think it's still a jurisdictional problem, but we have to deal with those 1985 amendments and the requirement that those things be raised pre-trial. But you don't waive your protection against double jeopardy, and you certainly shouldn't have to waive your protection against double jeopardy when the jury acquitted you. But again, all of that aside, that's the easiest way to get to where we need to go. If we don't want to go there, I think we still have to give a square look in the eye to the issue of sufficiency. And I think another way of looking at it is, does res judicata prevent the court's consideration of the intoxication principles when passing on the second count? We have to give respect to the jury's verdict of acquittal in every way that it matters. And this isn't a case like in Dunn, for example, where there were significant differences both in what was required elementally and what was proven factually between counts one and count two, so that while they're the same crime, they're only really the same crime in name. This is the exact same crime. It is intoxication manslaughter with a shell game of language to call it something else. It's still an intox manslaughter case. The same proof, the same evidence. Functionally, it's just a different way of spelling out the same element of the crime.
And what you're suggesting, though, it seems to me as a practical matter that the jury would have to be instructed, if you acquit on intoxication manslaughter, then you cannot consider.
Well, the judge had the power.
Consumption in manslaughter.
The judge had the power to refuse to submit count two to the jury, and that's what the court should have done. And the fact that there's a discussion in the charge conference about that, which is something I point out. It's not completely just an argument made for the first time on appeal. There was debate in the charge conference about this, and the court just wasn't hearing it. But I mean, this is charging law 101.
It'd be like in having one dropped.
I'm sorry,
that you've tried. Have you had success in having if they've been charged, both charged like this? In this case, have you had success in
I've had much less success in forcing judges to make the state elect, but I have seen the state elect of its own volition in the face of a motion to quash before. There was a case that never went to appeal because it was a not guilty, Malloy, in which this exact same issue came up, and that's how the state charged it. We filed objections and moved to quash. Court denied it, but the state, I think, realized then, they do not now, you can't do that. And they abandoned count two before it proceeded to jury trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you. Very interesting. The case will be under submission.